I believe this is the third audio for the Core Methods module on symmetry, and we are going to continue proving little results, and we are going to continue with lemma 1.3. So let's have a look. So far, we have defined what the proof is. We have looked at many, many examples and also counterexamples where something went wrong. So we got a feeling for the strength of the axioms, and we showed some little properties. The next property is what I call the cancellation rules. And for these, we have a group, again, with a binary operation that I call dot. And we have three group elements, A, B, and C. And then the cancellation rules say what probably all of you would expect, right? If this wasn't a lemma, I'm sure that you would just intuitively use it in your calculations. If I have a situation where A times B is the same as C times B, then we can cancel out the B, and we just get that A is equal to C. And also, the other way around, if we have A times B equals A times C, so if the identical element is on the left-hand side, in this case A, then again we can cancel it, and we obtain that B is equal to C. Now, let's prove these cancellation rules, and let's see how the cleaned whiteboard holds up. With what we have been doing. Oh, and I really like the violet. So let's see. This is the proof of lemma 1.3. And I would like to begin with the first statement where the letter B is the same on both sides of the equation. So A times B is C times B. Or maybe I have to turn this a little bit so you can read. Is it okay like this? Yeah, is that okay still? Right. Suppose that A times B is C times B. We don't know anything. We only have a group and the group axioms. But there is information there that helps us. So for example, we know that B, little b, is an element from our group, and every element in the group has an inverse. In particular, little b has an inverse in the group. So let's see what happens when we multiply this whole equation with the inverse of b. Now, does it matter where I multiply with it? Where should I multiply with it? From?
From the right.
From the right-hand side, exactly. Because we don't know whether we can swap. Usually we can't. Yes, thank you for paying attention. Since G is the group, we have the inverse in G, and we obtain A times B inverse, and now I do brackets before I remove them again. A times B inverse is the same as C times B times the inverse. The argument we do now is a little bit different from what we did before. Before, very often we started with an expression in the group, and then we had lots of equation signs, and we manipulated and we changed things, blah, blah, blah. And then for each equation sign, I always gave you some justification why the equation holds. This time it's different because we start with an equation and we want to prove another equation. So now an equation and another equation, they are usually not the same. We cannot just say, oh, they equal each other and I give arguments. And in fact, we have to find language for manipulating an equation and for saying this equation becomes another equation, or an equation holds after manipulating both sides in whatever way, and we have to find arguments for why the new equation holds rather than just manipulating terms. That's a bit different. So let's see how we can find language to write this down. So what did I do now? I took an equation that held in our group, and I took both sides and I multiplied with B inverse, and then since the two sides here were the same, they are still the same after multiplying with the same element. So this is an easy argument. But we have to make sure it holds in a group, because we have never done many calculations in a group, so we have to make sure we are not doing anything stupid. Now, I'm sure that you all have some intuition about what we want to do next. What is your intuition?
Associativity.
Associativity, we want to move the brackets. And the left-hand side can just be manipulated. We can just move the brackets and then keep manipulating this as we did before. So we could just extend the equality and do some work here on the left-hand side. Let's just do that. So let's just write this here is equal to, let's stick to the colors we have. So this is G2, associativity. This is A times in brackets B times B inverse, and now B and B inverse cancel each other out, so this product is the neutral element 1G, which, let me do this. So we get A on the left hand side, and what I used was B times B inverse is 1, so this is G4, and 1 is neutral for the multiplication, this is G3, and we end up with A. And now I can do the same thing on the right-hand side. So there is another way of writing this argument down, and we can discuss it in a moment. But for now, I felt that I wanted to start with a new equation and then work on both sides and always give arguments why what I'm doing is okay. So let's do the same on the right-hand side. Very similar. Again, I change the brackets. I replace BB inverse by 1. And I can see, and the justification is the same, G2, G4, G3. In the end, the new equation we get is A equals C, which is what we wanted. Now, let's briefly discuss other ways how we could have presented this, because the way I wrote this, maybe it's only easy to understand if you see me doing it and if you can basically see the progression of this equation. Whereas if you come in here and you just see this equation on the board without all the explanation, then maybe you wonder how it happened. So in a book, for example, if you saw it like this, maybe you would wonder, how does she know that she has to start with A and then do all these manipulations until over there? This is something that you can write down in hindsight. And maybe it's also not a bad thing to do this and then to say, actually, this is how you come up with this idea. What we did here, because we had time and because you could see me do it, was a mixture of both. So I started developing the argument from the middle, and in the end what you see is one long equation. How could we have done it differently? What have you seen? I mean, I'm sure you see manipulations of equations all the time. How do people usually explain what's going on? How are you able to follow it? And how do they explain whether the argument only goes one way or maybe both ways and you can actually return, which is not always true? How do people do that? No idea about another? I mean, if all of you think this is great, that's fine. I just wanted to see whether there's another way to write this that is maybe closer to the culture of explanations you are coming from. Maybe it's different. So I'm trying to...
You can write anyone's CD, and then, but then I'm not sure if there are a lot of bad things here, but subtract.
Subtract?
Yeah, so you can write A minus CD and then write A minus C times B equals 0.
What is 0?
Oh, there is nothing about it. Right inside. Subtract CD from both sides.
What is subtraction?
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. So if you're not allowed to do that, then I don't know the other way, but if you're allowed to subtract...
We are allowed to. I don't understand what it means. So in this context, our universe is the group G with the dot, and I don't know what subtraction and what zero is.
Okay.
This is a very, very mathematical mindset now that I'm taking. This is my universe. I have no idea what's happening outside. Oh yeah, I heard of strange people who use zero and no idea. So therefore, I could not just take one side and something else and subtract because it has no meaning in this world. Would there be another way to just manipulate equations and to write down explanations? Is there an intuitive way for you to do that? So maybe similar to what you were saying, but still keeping this language and staying in the universe where we started. I want to give you options for your own arguments. No idea? So now we have to, if you're all happy with that, that's fine. If you want to see an alternative, then I can just suggest one and we can see how you like that. Who wants me to suggest an alternative? Okay, so let's see what this could look like. Alternative. We start with the equation as we did. We get the second equation as we did. So this is what we have in the middle. And now I will not continue on the left and on the right hand side, but instead I will keep staring at this equation and I will manipulate the whole equation, both sides at once. And I do it in ways where I can find an argument why it's okay and why it's still an equation. For example, I could say, because of G2, this becomes, and now I do the change on both sides at once, then we use G4 and have a new equation, and I keep messing up the colors, I'm sorry. But I quite like it to have the color scheme, right? And then we have A times 1 equals C times 1. Finally, G3 yields A times C. What is the difference? It's really a philosophical difference, I think, but maybe you can find words for it and maybe you can tell me what you prefer, if you have a preference. So for me, this is different, really. Maybe it's not for you.
Actually, I did this initially and then I looked at what you did, so I
This was what you thought?
Yeah, that is. Mm-hmm. This is what I did, actually.
Yeah, so you take the equation and then you manipulate both sides and you just make sure that every time the equality sign stays and you're not doing anything stupid.
Yeah.
Right.
So this is like your first step in the first proof that you manipulate both sides of the equation. Then you have some implication, but it does not necessarily do it the other way.
Exactly. So the way I do it here, I could have replaced all the words. I like words. I could have replaced them by implication arrows with the justification on top, which is what many people do. So and the arrows are fine as long as you use them consciously, knowing what you do. The problem with these arrows is that lots of people use them not knowing what they do.
Yeah.
So they will write arrows that go in both directions without checking that both directions hold. And this is how mistakes happen. Therefore, in your own writing, in your own solutions, feel free to use this to abbreviate all the words with arrows, just making sure you know what you're doing with the arrows. That's fine. And often this is very short. And it's completely up to you which way you prefer. So we can continue, because we have another cancellation rule, which looks almost the same, except for this time the same letter is not on the right-hand side, but it's on the left-hand side. So basically, you can tell me now what to do. Right? I don't have to do it by myself, you can tell me. And we can practice the arrows writing if you like. We can do it once together and make sure we do it nicely and properly and... So the other equation was A times B is A times C. Then Usually I don't like this so much, so I prefer words. I do not like to use very, very short formal language in the middle of a proof that started with words, but if we do it separately, so now we start like this and then we say then, or maybe then the following is true, and then we do a bunch of calculations and a bunch of things which is formal logical science, it's okay as long as we know what we're doing. And as I said before, often we see the symbols used in the wrong way or in an ambiguous way. Just be careful, don't repeat mistakes you see. That's what I'm saying, I think. But here we can try to be correct about this. What would be the next equation that you would write down?
We multiply inverse.
Which one? From the left, and which one? Which inverse?
A inverse.
A inverse, yes. A times C, it should be. And then? So let's do it with the arrow, and then I need to write down a justification. What should it be? The next one? What do I do?
Associative.
Mm-hmm, G2. You can also write associative, it doesn't matter. Right. And then I change the brackets. Blah, blah, blah. You see where it's going, right? Maybe I don't need to finish it. But the next step would be canceling this out and writing the identity element. So just for orientation, I'm going to write this. And then you know what's going on and everything is fine. And the exercise for you is to think about why we need two cancellation rules. So we are going to discuss this tomorrow, because it looks as if one should be enough. We're doing the same arguments with. Okay. Anything? Any more comments or questions before we move on?
Could you make them more strict, that you also say not only if then, but also if then and only then?
If and only if?
Yeah.
Let's think about this. This is a very nice question. So you're asking whether you can say A times B is C times B if and only if A times C. One direction we have just proven, we've proven that you can cancel the B. The other direction would be if you can multiply with B on both sides. Can we?
Yes.
Yes, and it's the easier direction. So this is one of these situations where we don't write if and only if, because one of the directions is so elementary that we don't even bother writing it down. But you're right, it holds. We could make this an if and only if statement, because if we have an equation and then we multiply by the same group element from the same side, the equation still holds. Yes, thank you.
And we could then also, in the proof, use the two-sided arrow. Just instead of just the implication in one direction, you could say that it's correct in both directions.
We could. In that case, let's think about it for a moment. From here to here, this middle part, we use that if you have an equation in a group. So what does this mean? It means that we have one group element, but we have two ways to represent it. And they might be the same or they might be different. We don't know. This is what this says. And then we say, okay, so now if I have this group element, then I can multiply it with another group element and I get a group element. And these two representations kind of survive the process and we can still write them down. There's nothing really happening. We're not doing a computation. We're just using two different representations of the same group element. Can I reverse this? Would it be okay to write the arrow in both directions? I ask everyone, because this is a very interesting question.
B has to be in that group, but to B have its inverse.
Yes, all the elements have to come from the group. Yes, yes. That was something that I said in the beginning, A, B, and C, O, and G. Otherwise, this would not be clear.
You could just, if you wanted to show the other direction, you could just multiply with B again from the right side and cancel.
Yes. So you would repeat the argument we are actually doing, because the inverse of B inverse is B. Right. If you don't do it that way, so if you do what you just described, then you're not saving any time, because you have to give an argument we give anyway. If you just put a an error in both directions here, then you are using the argument that we are actually trying to prove, because then you say you can cancel the B inverse. So that's why I'm not doing that, because it would be like a shortcut, but it would be claiming that what we want to prove already holds, we can already reverse it, we can already cancel. If we don't want to say that, but if we want to give an argument, then we have to multiply with the inverse of B inverse again, and then we're basically just doing what we're doing all the time. So I'm not seeing how it simplifies it. It could only be useful maybe for later arguments. So I'm thinking that if ever in any calculation there's any doubt that this is an if and only if, then it might be valuable going back and making it stronger and writing if and only if, and then doing errors in both directions all the time and justifying it, which is fine, because then maybe later there will be an argument where it's easier to point to the lemma and say, oh, we're using it in the other direction. I've never actually seen it. I've never seen a situation where this would have made life easier, just because multiplying such an equation with a group element from the same side is such an elementary thing to do. So I never felt like I wanted to use a lemma for that. It might be good for, what's the word I'm looking for? Sensibilisierung. It might be good for just taking this sort of half a step back and thinking, oh, actually, oh yes, it's an if and only if. So just what we did right now. I think this discussion is useful. Using the lemma with the other direction, I'm not sure if it's so useful, it doesn't save time.
No, it's not useful, but you commented that you see people using the arrow sign wrong. But in this case, it would be right also to you.
It would be, yes. You would have to think about whether the justification you gave for one direction is the same as the other, and sometimes it is, and sometimes it's not. But even then, it's fine. So I also sometimes do it in my lectures, so I would write if and only if, and then I would just give different arguments for these both ways, but have it compactly together. Yeah, sure, I do that, yes. Yeah. And the other thing is not even a mistake. Writing down less than you know is okay. So writing down an error in just one direction, even though you know it goes both ways, is fine. No one will blame you for it if it's not needed in any further argument. Okay, any more comments or questions on this little cancellation lemma? Then we should move on, because now, as you can see, this is where I want to ask you whether you need more examples, whether you want to see examples for using the cancellation rule, for example, or examples for other lemmas, how to use them, how to apply them, or if you need any reminders of anything before we move on, because now I want to motivate the next little step for today. What is there that you need? Do you need illustrations, examples for anything that we've discussed? One thing that I really encourage you to do is to look at all these results, in particular results where we did something that involved checking the ordering of things, and look for structures where the ordering plays a role, and look for examples where you can actually see that it matters. For example, we have this dilemma where we say, if we multiply two elements and then take the inverse, then we need to take the inverses in the other ordering and then multiply them. And I challenge you to find a group where you can really see that this change in ordering matters and where otherwise things would go wrong. Right? That's a little extra homework for you. So this is what this question is about. Do you need more examples, deeper examples, examples that really show why the ordering sometimes plays a role? If you're not asking me about it now, then I challenge you to find them yourself, which is more fun anyway. And we move on to substructures. As an algebraist, this is my natural way of thinking. I see an interesting structure, I study it for a bit, I look for examples, and then I'm thinking, oh, if you restrict this, do you get an interesting substructure? If you do this, do you get an interesting substructure? How can you find smaller things within a big thing? Or how can you find something that you see here, maybe within a smaller thing? Can you kind of transplant it over there? Things like that. So I'm always interested in substructures. And I would like to motivate you and discuss with you where we naturally find them and why they are maybe interesting in your context. Actually, we have seen an example earlier today. Maybe you remember that we looked at permutations of the set 1, 2, 3. Now I extend it and I say 1, 2, 3, 4. And depending on whether you look at permutations of the set without any structure, so the numbers are just floating around, they can go wherever they want, we can restrict it by building a square and numbering the corners 1 to 4. And then we have less freedom. We saw this earlier today. So this would be a square like this. And if we don't want to break the square, if we want to keep it intact, then we cannot use all the permutations of the set. We have to be careful that the geometry of the square is respected. We could look for other objects where we can number something 1, 2, 3, 4. Maybe some people here play games like board games or role play games where you have dice. With dice. Yeah, dice one, dice several, thank you. With a variation of the number of sides. So W20, B20 in German would be a very, very well-known die for like role-play games and so on. But also, you could have a die that has just four sides. So what would this look like? This would be like this. And then the sides would be, for example, maybe the bottom is a 1, and then we have a 2 in the front, and a 3 on the side, and a 4 at the back, and I have no idea how I'm supposed to draw that. Maybe like this. What I'm saying is that if we take a group, for example, the group of permutations of the set, and if we impose an extra condition on group elements, so they should do something extra than just being such a permutation, then maybe we get fewer elements, and the question is whether or not this gives us an interesting substructure in the group. One more example, here's a graph. The graph has four vertices, of course, because we're talking about 1 to 4. And maybe the graph looks like this. What are the permutations of the set 1, 2, 3, 4 that also respect the structure of this graph? So again, you see that in many, many modeling contexts and many simulation contexts, you might see symmetry that you could model with the set of permutations of everything that is around there, but you don't need it, because if you impose the symmetry that you see, if you impose some combinatorial or geometric or whatever constraints, then you get fewer permutations and it restricts the amount of modeling you have to do. And in programming algorithms, this is a very, very powerful tool. So very often when we program search algorithms that are used by algebras, so they search in groups, for example, big groups, then we can limit the amount of search that needs to be done by ideas just like this. And it makes harder problems solvable, and it makes algorithms quicker and easier to manipulate and to refine and so on. So these are powerful ideas, and they start very easily. They start with a question. If we have a big group and then we impose some extra structure, how do we get the group to be smaller? And does this substructure, again, exhibit all the properties of a group? Because if it does, it's great. Then we can just use our whole theory for this smaller thing. So this gives us the language of subgroups. And I want to just give you a definition briefly. Here. Is this okay, the size? Can you read okay? Thank you. Thank you for the thumbs and for the smiling faces. That's excellent. We have a subset. The sign here that I'm using is the subset sign, and the little equality sign here says that it's allowed to be the full set. I'm differentiating between subset and subgroup. By differentiating between the subset sign, which is round, and the subgroup sign, that is like a little triangle almost. So it looks like less than. Now, for a subset to be a subgroup, it must be true that if you take the binary operation on G and you restrict it to the subset, then you get a group again. So it should be a group in itself with the same binary operation restricted to it. Let's look at some examples. Let's look at some examples. Actually, I will look at this in a minute, but first I would, this is a little bit advanced. Let's start with something very simple. Let's take the integers and plus. This is a beautiful little group. Can you see any subset that is a subgroup? The first checks you need to do is it has to be closed under the same operation. N, is it closed under the same operation? No. So it might be the first idea to look for a subset that we know and to check. And then the first check should be, is it closed under the binary operation? The naturals are not. So, sorry, not a subgroup, just an interesting subset. Any other ideas? Can you describe the set of numbers that you are just defining? Do you have other words?
No.
Or examples? What numbers are they?
2, 4, even numbers.
Even numbers. 2, 4, 6, blah blah blah. 0, -2, -4. Okay. Set of even numbers. Set of even integers. Let's check. It's a subset of the integers, that's fine. Is it closed under the binary operation? Okay, so we need to check whether if we take two even numbers and we add them, whether we get again an even number.
Yes.
And we do, yes. And actually we can formally prove this if we write down the set of even numbers in a mathematical proper way, and if you want to practice this, fine, and then tell me tomorrow how it went. It's closed under plus. What about the associativity law? Well, okay, it holds for all the integers. Of course it holds for the subsets. We never have to check that. That's boring. What about a neutral element?
Zero.
Zero. Yeah, it works. It's in there. It works. Great. What about inverses?
Yeah.
Here, we just have to check. I mean, the set of even integers is a subset, so that they do have inverses in the integers. We just have to check whether they are contained in the subset, and if they are, then everything is fine. So we can see that if there is this big structure above, the big mother group, so to speak, then we don't even need to check all the group axioms. It seems as if we get away with checking a little bit less. That's good. We are going to make this even better later. What about the odd integers?
Does it contain zero? Does it contain zero?
Is zero an odd number?
No.
It's not odd.
It's not, neither odd nor even.
Oh, it's even.
Okay.
Yeah, because even integers are defined as integers of the form 2 times an integer, and 0 is 2 times 0. Otherwise, the set of even integers wouldn't be a subgroup, because 0 would be missing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's even. But it's interesting, I always have this discussion, also in my first year courses, I always have this discussion about whether 0 is even or odd, or maybe nothing at all. That's interesting. Why is it strange for people to think that 0 is even? Interesting. So for me it's completely natural that even is that zero is an even number. Right. So zero is not contained here, but maybe this is not so bad. Maybe this has just a different neutral element. It doesn't have to be the same, as far as we know, at least. Right? Maybe we have to be creative. What do you think? Is the set closed under the operation? Example?
And 3 plus 5 is 8.
3 plus 5, thank you. 3 and 5 are odd. 3 plus 5 is 8, is not odd. Doo-doo. Lost. So we have a yes here, and we have a no here. And I challenge you to generalize the first example. So here we took all even numbers, all multiples of 2. What about multiples of 3? Try and find it out. Maybe there is a rule that multiples of a fixed number always give a subgroup. And maybe you can manipulate this and find more interesting subgroups. So that's a little challenge. And then let's go back, now that we are kind of warmed up, let's go back to the structures at the top, where we started with all permutations of the set 1, 2, 3, 4. Do we think that the symmetries of the square, which means those permutations of 1, 2, 3, 4 that respect the square geometry, do we think that they build a subgroup? It sounds natural enough, but we have seen that things can go terribly wrong, so let's double check. If I take two permutations that respect the square and I put one after the other, will the composition still respect the square?
Can you repeat what you just said?
Mm-hmm. So now I take the subset of permutations of 1, 2, 3, 4 that respects the square. It's not all of them. We had seen that there are examples where the square gets broken. But if we say that we respect the square, for example, it could be a rotation or maybe a reflection, and we express it by interchanging the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, i.e. the corners, and the square structure needs to be respected, so the lines have to be lines after again. If we have two such maps, for example, one rotation and another rotation, or it could be one rotation and one reflection, or maybe something completely different, but if we put them one after the other, will the composition also respect the square structure, do you think? Or could it happen that we have two permutations and they both respect the square structure, but then when we apply them one after the other, everything gets messed up? Shouldn't get messed up, right? No. If the world is somehow okay, then if you respect it twice, it should still be respected at the end with its geometry. Okay, so we think, we have not proven it, but we will come to that. We think for now that it works with the composition of maps. So that would be G1. Associativity law, we don't have to prove anything. What about a neutral element? Which permutation do we have to take that could serve as a neutral element for the symmetries of the square? Which one could it be? With maps, it's always the same. Hmm? The identity, do nothing. Yeah, do nothing. Mm-hmm. Okay, 3 out of 4. So for G4, we need inverses. Now, every permutation that respects the square has an inverse, of course, because it's a permutation. But the question is whether the inverse respects the square. So what do we think? Will the inverse respect the square? It should, right? If it respects distances, angles, blah, 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 the inverse should too. Otherwise, how could they together become the identity map? So intuitively speaking, without proving anything rigorously, we think that the permutations of the set 1, 2, 3, 4 that respect the square structure build a subgroup. And the same if you take any other interesting combinatorial object. For some reason, there is something fundamental going on there. If you have such a set of permutations and you have a group with composition of maps, and then you build an interesting structure that is numbered with these numbers, if it's in any way, if the definition is in any way natural, and if the object is not completely strange, then some of these permutations that you have there will respect the structure and they will form a subgroup. And this is where many, many, many interesting groups come into the world. So they are not groups of permutations of a gigantic set, not all of them, but they will be subgroups that respect some interesting structures. This is how they enter our sphere of action. This is how we would naturally see them. For example, they would respect a crystal structure or something like this. Right, let's prove things about subgroups then. Apparently, they are natural and important. And something that I would like to do when I introduce such a new concept is I would like to become lazy and not do all this superfluous work. Now, when we checked for subgroups, we always needed to go through all the four axioms, G1, G2, G3, G4, and we saw that G2 doesn't really need to be checked. For the others, we also sometimes had an idea how it could be simplified, so it looks as if there is some simplification possible behind all this, and maybe we just need to understand it a little better before we can write down what it is. This next lemma here, lemma 2.1, goes a long way towards doing that, because we now understand a little bit better what is going on in a subgroup. We have a group, G, with binary operation dot, and we have a subgroup. So maybe you notice this is not round, it's, what's the word, eckig? Yeah, it's like less than, but I'm wondering what the difference is in English between this rounded thing and the edgy thing, maybe edgy. Doesn't matter. So use less than G in a formal language, so use a subgroup. And then I claim that the identity element of G is actually contained in U, which means that it's the same as the identity element of U. And if we have an element in U, then its inverse, that we know of in the big group G, is contained in the subgroup U. So everything is just as we saw in our little examples before. And it's not hard to prove. We are going to do this now. And this will pave the way to what I call the subgroup criterion, namely very little things that are easy to check usually, so that we can find subgroups quicker. Let's see. I made all these comments, I think.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sure, just a sec. Let me just find the right place in my notes. There we are. And now I can listen to you. Yes?
So when you were discussing about like how you're representing four numbers in a group as a square, and then you made this, so I didn't completely get what's the significance of a square is.
Mm-hmm. It's putting on constraints, which means that the numbers cannot be commuted in any way. For example, if I commute only 1 and 2, if they change places and everything else stays the same, then the square is messed up.
Yeah.
Because these change, but the lines do
yeah,
not change. So this is the significance of the square.
And you're constraining some things about the group.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So constraining is a very good word. Thank you. I will use this. So the idea would be that we have this big universe of all permutations, and 4 is a very small number, so in
yeah.
reality it would be much larger. And this group of permutations is gigantic. We don't want to do calculations in there. Everything is very messy.
Yeah.
Instead, we are trying to constrain the situation. We are trying to find some structure that is imposed there
yeah.
that reduces the number of group elements we have to look at.
Yeah.
And if we're lucky, then these group elements will not just float about, but they will be a subgroup.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the idea.
Are you using implicitly some kind of representation theory for
no.
this square? Because
no.
for a square we have angles and lengths. And
yes.
But all this is not implied here. You only have maybe something like a graph. Yeah, vertices
yes.
and.
Yes. So at the moment it's pure intuition, and later I will introduce symmetries of a regular n-gon, and then this is a regular four-gon, of course. And I will introduce them as bijective maps from a set of points to itself such that distances are preserved, and that is enough. It could be done differently, but I don't want to talk about length and angles and stuff. I just want to have a simple thing that gives a constraint, and being distance preserving is enough for what we're doing. And representation theory does not enter the picture. No. But you're right that very often when we talk about geometrical objects, we could move to other objects that are maybe even simpler to describe, and we would still get the same information. Yeah. In this case, I took something very intuitive, because it was the first example.
But
thank
I don't
you.
See where the distances would come into play here.
Being distance preserving means that a neighbor of 1 cannot be mapped to 3.
No.
I mean, at least not if 1 is fixed. So if 1 is fixed, then the distance preservation means that 2 and 4 can only stay or swap places, but they can never move to 3 because the distance is further. So this is where it becomes relevant. And this is also where it's a bit different from a graph. Because there with a graph, it's only a matter of how I write it on the board. There are no distances. And at least, I mean, there are graph theoretic distances, but they are different from the distances I mean here. So this would be in or to Euclidean distance, blah, 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 but of course you can do it differently. Yeah. Yeah, there are so many ways how you can impose constraints, and finding good constraints and then using them is one of the little pieces of art that enter the theory here, I think. Right, where were we? We wanted to prove something. Let us move on the board. I think there might be enough room there. Yeah, and then I need to give it some cleaning and you can have a little break. So the proof that we want to do, namely for lemma 2.1, starts with our hypothesis that we have a group and a subgroup. And the first thing we want to show is that the neutral element 1 of G is contained in the subgroup. First of all, I would like to state that U is a subgroup, which means that it has to have elements in it, because we explained earlier that groups are never the empty set, which means there is something, some element in the group, and I call it little U. U is not the empty set, and we let U in U. To make sure I use my notation from here. I would like to multiply U with a neutral element, and I have two possibilities now how I can do this, right? Because the little U exists now in two different lands. So it exists in U land, the subgroup, and it also exists in G land, the big group. And both groups have a neutral element because they are groups. So we're using the axiom G3 two times. And if we use it for the subgroup U, then we see that if we multiply little u by the neutral element, 1u, then nothing changes. Then u is the same as u times 1u, and this is G3 applied to u. And I write this u here, so you see that I'm using it for the subgroup. But also, I can multiply u with the neutral element from the big group, g, and again, I just get u. It doesn't get more interesting than that. So this is g3, but in the group g. This means that I can now write an equation, namely u times 1u is the same as u times 1g. I have an equation where on the left-hand side I have the same element. This looks like a cancellation situation. Right? Let's do this. Now this means that u times 1u is the same as u times 1g, and cancellation gives 1g is the same as 1u. Ha! We used the cancellation rules. Yay! First thing proved. Next thing. Inverses.
If u belongs to the subgroup u, then there exists u inverse, which also belongs to u. Doesn't that follow from the definition?
Oh, yes, I need to clarify this. So when I write u inverse, then I mean the inverse of little u in the big group g.
Okay.
And I say that this is contained in the subgroup u. All I know now is that if u is a subgroup, then there exists an inverse for little u in the subgroup, but it could be different. So, we have to pretend we don't know anything. We are stupid and we have no idea what's going on, which means that if we see subgroup, then everything we know in the subgroup might not have anything to do with the big group land outside. We have no idea what it looks like. So, there is a little u star, and it might be u inverse, but we don't know yet. Which is exactly what is happening now, so we are now going to clarify. And actually, I'm just checking now how I call this inverse of little u in u, and I did not call it u star, I call it v. Now that u in u, using G4 actually, for u and big u, so little u and big u, Let V in big U be such that U times B is 1 U, which is the same as 1 G. We are going to use that in a moment, but now everything I do refers to the subgroup U, which is why I'm writing 1 U. Then, okay, what can we do? To me, it looks like I want to use what we just did. I would like to start here. U times V is the same as 1 U, which is the same as 1 G, C above. Can I just write C above? C above, is that okay? I do it with my students. Is it okay? C above. And now I'm writing 1 G, using that G is a group and that little u is an element in the group, and therefore it does have an inverse there, namely u inverse. Which means I'm now writing this as u times u inverse in the big group G, using G4 in the big group G. And now again, it looks like cancellation, because on the left-hand side of the equation, we have a u. On the right-hand side, there's something, and then cancellation tells us that something must be the same group element, which means that V is actually the same as U inverse, so now we have seen that actually the inverses are the same. Cancellation gives V is U inverse. Now, this is great. It means that once we have a subgroup, everything is the way it should be. No surprises, and this will help us to understand how we can see that a subset is a subgroup. Actually, let me check the time. I think I want us to have a little break. Let's take 10 minutes before we move on and we prove the next few things about subgroups. There's not much more, as you have seen maybe in the short notes, there's not much more than we can do. Some more about subgroups, some more examples. Check again against the exercises whether there's anything we need to discuss, and then I can give you some motivation for tomorrow. Right? 10 minutes, maybe 15, so we can get tea and coffee and stuff. Okay? See you in a moment.